If you'd like to take your seat so that we can in a miraculous way, Ricky finished her talk at 12 o'clock.
Exactly.
But it's 12:15, so we will do a 20-minute discussion, and then we'll do another small break. Huh? Is that right?
Yeah, very good idea.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know how do you want to do it.
Free for all. Hmm?
Free for all. Anyway, yeah, definitely free for all. Can I take the advantage of making the first set of questions? Am I allowed?
You are.
I mean, starting, you can say something to Fiorette. I mean, what I said previously, that somehow this new emphasis on achievement and you know, the civilized manners of the children seems to contradict with what is really the substance of at least most aspects, dimensions of domestic work, which is dealing with dirt. And therefore, I mean, if we want to pursue a kind of symbolic analysis of these tasks, the task of taking somebody who is compatible with bringing up your children and, you know, so that you will achieve great things in life, with the task of taking somebody who is going to deal with dirt, seem to be, I mean, seem not to match in a straightforward manner. And I suppose the question that arises on this remark is what kind of new type of division of labor emerges out of this step for children's situation. On the other hand, I understand that your main point is that really what we have here is a major change or a change in the type of family and household, which in a way has to be followed up by transformations perhaps in the sphere of domestic work as well. Am I thinking the right direction? I don't know. I mean, I'm...
That's a very good question. Very good question. Should I talk now or wait?
Should we?
Can I answer? Since
I mean, yes, yeah, okay.
I think also that it's linked with class formation and class reproduction on a symbolic level. Mm-hmm. So perhaps it's a factor that should be considered. And it would be interesting to see what... who does the dirty work generally outside the household too? Whether it's gardening or it's because these middle-class homes have also utilized labor for that kind of thing, and perhaps seek to control the symbolic, in a strict way, boundaries of the household, having a little bit of. Not a little bit, more than a little bit, inside image and experience of American society. It's also like who you allow in your home, and that who is sometimes you don't allow anybody, but you allow somebody outside the boundaries, whether it's your garden, whether it's your... So it's also that symbolic boundary of the house and how it's guarded.
May I also add just a little piece of information about again about the step for children? There was a European survey of young adolescents, and the image appearing from the survey is that in fact in Greece this image is reproducing itself, and for example, they found that about 20% of young school children in Greece they have very little contact with their parents, who had no time for them, but also that much more than adolescents in other European countries, they spent their time in extra school activities. And, but this means that this cultivation of the children is not given to somebody within the home, but to other carers outside. But the prototype, I think, of the Stepford child is coming also to Greece.
Yeah. I
have
a related question as well.
Yeah. Okay, I come.
Yeah, I found it really interesting because in your original work, Theoret, you were, which I found very interesting, you were making the point where we have this kind of stereotype about who it is who has a domestic worker, and you make the point in California that slowly but surely it was filtering down through the class system, so more and more people were hiring domestic workers. And I wondered if you sort of translate that into your cultivated superstar child, how far does this sediment down in terms of class?
Yes.
That's a good question.
I don't know. Because it is really class formation, so, isn't
that's
it?
Right.
The Dimitris.
It's class.
I wanted to add something about this research. There is a disparity between what children think about the time parents spend and what parents think.
Yes.
It's very interesting.
Yes.
And I want to add a question which is relevant. If this Stepford child scheme is reproduced by migrant domestic workers as far as their children at other levels.
Helen.
First of all, I wanted to say that I found very interesting that actually the domestic workers themselves are trying to use the same standards for the education of their children. So they are expecting many domestic workers in Greece that I have worked with. They told me actually that they would like their children to reach the level of civility, let's say, educational, not simply educational overachievement, but also the level of civility that Greek children have. So they are actually spending a lot of money on private lessons for their children, domestic workers themselves. This is one thing. The second thing is an anecdote about a Greek family, a very wealthy Greek family that I know personally, and I think it's very interesting. They have a four-year-old son, and when he was born, they hired a Polish nanny, which was considered appropriate because she could speak English. She couldn't speak Greek, but she could speak English, so the child would learn English. When the child reached the age of four, they decided to fire her and hire a nanny that couldn't speak Greek and couldn't speak English. So basically, she couldn't communicate with the child. And I asked them, why? I mean, to me, it doesn't make any sense, even from a class perspective. And the answer was that now the child needs our guidance to move forward. So we don't want her to intervene in his education. I think this is very telling of the situation.
Okay, would you like to just say a few words?
A small point related to that, which is again about class formation and the fact that this idea of at a certain age the child must have similarity rather than difference in the brought in thing. That's a very old tradition in the UK. I mean, and a very famous example of it is Diana Spencer, who did exactly that before she married the future king, was go and care for children. I was actually trained to do that in other people's households. Yeah. And that is a thing that goes back a couple of hundred years, at least in the UK upper classes. Mm-hmm. So that's it. I was kind of very intrigued that this is being reproduced in a different, slightly different form in LA. And the other thing about the Greek case, which I find really fascinating, is there's there's an utter distrust of the state educational system, it would seem to me, in what I'm describing here. And so you have to kind of double up the education of the child through private, extremely expensive private institutions that will give the child the education that the state is believed not being provided by the schools. They have to go to the school by law, but they kind of double up the schooling. And so I'm astonished by these kids who seem to be working up to 10 p.m., well, in theory, up to 10 p.m., ridiculous ages, and yet they come to the University of Manchester as undergraduate students and seem to sit in coffee shops all day, so I'm not quite sure how that works. So, anyway.
Yeah. Let's finish with this and then we...
Can I put something just back
on
top of Sarah? But, I think the other thing that happens in that, I was very struck by that too, that age. And the classic British thing is, of course, boarding school. That, you know, that for complete class reproduction, you have the lower class but well into discipline but also affectionate nanny. And then you're packed off, particularly if you're a boy, to learn how to reproduce your class within boarding school. And so in some ways, it's both of those are saying that the family is the context, or the household's the context for having the child, but the training of it is outside the family, which I think is really interesting, and a completely class link.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the governance, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are all really good questions and comments. I tried to chop these down as fast as I could. You begin with this new emphasis of achievement. Who's cleaning? Who's taking care of the dirt? which is pretty essential. Well, I think there's a new division of labor when it comes to the sphere of paid domestic work, so that in wealthier households you might see somebody who does exclusively the cleaning and somebody who's exclusively with the children. But I think the major upshot is that there's now that class reproduction and the reproduction of households and cultivation of children now depends on a whole host of services and extra household services that are needed to cultivate the child, many of which are aimed at the academic realm, sports, music, blah, 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 all of this stuff, language. So there's sort of new occupations that have come online, and they're not, I don't think we would define them as paid domestic work, but there's certainly, you know, pitted against. Something I hinted at in my paper that I'd like to revisit is the retreat of highly educated women. I think in England, it certainly appears in popular culture, and in the United States, the retreat of women from career and public sphere into the home. I think on one hand being pushed out and the one hand being pulled in by, you know, particular ideals of nuclear family life and also these realities of cultivating the child. So Pei Chia Lan, who's a sociologist who's written about paid domestic work in Hong Kong, where Filipinas go, writes about there's sort of a hierarchy of what can be performed, right? And so she defines it like the spiritual and mental needs of the child can only be filled by mother or grandmother, not by the Filipina domestic worker. I'm glad somebody raised a question about gardeners, because I'm very enthusiastic to talk about gardening all the time. And gardeners, I'm about to start a project that looks at Latino immigrant men and gardeners. And in Los Angeles, it's not just domestic workers who are entering the homes and working. I mean, Los Angeles looks a little bit, you know, it's green, beautiful green verdant hills and suburbs. And there are many, many people entering households, middle-class households, to keep them up and going every day. And there's an institutionalized job of largely Mexican immigrant gardeners who arrive, brown men who would never be driving around, permitted to drive around in these neighborhoods.
I saw it in Long Island.
Yes, Long Island is big on services, right. Symbolically, yes, they're outside of the home, but they are allowed to go into neighborhoods and patios and yards every day. There's pool cleaners, there's painters, there's remodeling of all types. It is largely a Latino man's, it's a brown man's job today. So brings up all other kinds of questions about these symbolic boundaries. And also the questions, there's much more distance. You know, so it's not the same kind of intimacy that care workers or even cleaners have, I think, with their employers. And there's all kinds of questions I'm interested in terms of are they employees or are they businessmen, right? Because they maintain their own route. They're self-employed except for the men who work for them. But that's another discussion. Then there's this question from a couple of you about... I do see that domestic work in Los Angeles has gone, and many other places, has gone from being the province of the elites to now taking for granted necessity of the elderly, single parents, many people living on fixed or lower incomes. But how far down is this notion of the highly cultivated Stepford child filtering down? I don't know, but I think not far down. I mean, Annette LaRoe's book, the one I mentioned, Unequal Childhoods, I think is, the most authoritative look at this. And she finds radically distinctive modes of conceiving of childhood and approaching childhood among working class and poor families versus middle class and the professional class families. But then the question of migrant domestic workers is interesting because, of course, they're going in to take care of other people's children and butting right up against these different kinds of child-rearing strategies. I mean, what I've seen, and my own work didn't look specifically at this, but what I've seen is Latina domestic workers taking away some things, like learning timeout strategies for disciplining children as opposed to corporal punishment or smacking and spanking, or perhaps limiting, the amount of sugar, not necessarily replacing it with tofu, but something along those lines. And Los Angeles, there are Latina immigrant nannies employing nannies in their own homes, usually a more recently arrived teenager or older woman. But there simply aren't the resources for them, even if they do aspire to have their children go to university and become a doctor, where there simply are not the resources, time or financial or know-how to get all of those things, right? To schlep the kids around to all of these lessons and have the tutors, or even access to schools. And this point about Greeks having great distrust of the educational system is particularly relevant because California public schools are reputed to be at the bottom. But I think even among parents who have their children in private schools, there is this anxiety, this angst about creating the superstar kid. And if we were a group of psychologists, we could all talk about the sort of narcissistic needs of parents to live through child's needs. And here I think there is a kind of a particular gendered story that goes along with highly educated mothers being squeezed out or opting out of the labor force and living through the children's accomplishments. It's a different story.
It's for you.
Oh, it's for me. Oh, pardon me. Sorry. Twist it all around. Okay. Okay, please comment on the part that often small class housewives do volunteer work. Yeah, that's a very good point. So I've been asked to comment in the American case where middle class housewives do volunteer work in their communities, in schools, the PTA, the parent teachers organization, coaching. My husband, who's a sociologist, has been studying recently the whole phenomena of Little League and soccer coaching, which turns out to be extraordinarily gendered. So there, the women are in charge when all the children are very young. And then as soon as the children turn about six and really figure out what's going on in the game, even the women who were superstar athletes in college and who know the game are pushed out entirely, and male leadership is called forth, even if the men don't really know the game. I think that's kind of a general pattern that holds. On the one hand, middle-class women are running tremendous organizations and also receiving community kudos, right? Mm-hmm. Recognition for being president and secretary, making things happen, and for creating a collective good in these more exclusive neighborhoods. And mothers who work are deeply resented, I think, because right, there's people who don't pull their weight. But it's all about the children. You hear that all the time. It's all about the kids, and you hear parents say that with sort of an ironic detachment also. So it's still this concerted cultivation, and it's still the non-paid work that places women in sort of very traditional. Mm.
It seems that we all find that this focus on children is very invigorating in this discussion. And what I suggest is that the whole idea of the workshop is to have time for discussion. So if all contributors want to perhaps give more space to discussion by limiting their interventions, instead of 30 minutes, let's say 20 minutes or 25, I think that will help us to realize this wonderful task. I mean, putting new things and continuing with the older ones in new ways. Okay. So, please.
I would like to do a brief comment on these fascinating papers from the point of view of an historian who has done for a long time work on work and gender. And it's fascinating to see how the content of women's work, for instance, has the focus on of the study of women's work has changed in the last 15 years, from labor to proper labor, right? I mean, to, for instance, domestic work. And on the other hand, I heard your three papers as more papers on the reconstruction of households than on women's work, actually. And I think this is also fascinating. For instance, the point you raised of what's happening on the countries of origin of these migrant paid women doing paid household, which is a point that I think, from the little I know, that is not often raised and much less studied. Yeah. And I think that reconstruction of household at this point is as important as reconstruction of household at the places where these women find jobs. And the relevance between the two, I think, might be very interesting, and also a point into which men could be reintroduced in the study, so the gender would be more meanings of gender would be more plural and diversified. My question to. The question I wanted to ask Ricky is whether the people you worked with, apparently only women were domestic paid workers. Isn't that right?
Not all, but most.
Okay, so did this occupation have any relevance in what you found about gender ideology? because it seems to me that all three papers actually give new meaning in what in labor history, for instance, is has been studied in respect to women's importance in labor history and what their work meant for societies, I put it nicely. And I think that your three papers stress the fact that it is women who are agents of change in these cases, that the very different cases that we described, as much in their working relationships as in their own households, or as employees, in your case. So, probably many things, and I'm sorry if it's vague, but.
I think I have a related question. Yes. Should I come in on the same one? Because this shift from labour to work is not problematized, and I think I was very interested in this comment about what it was like to have a self-organized NGO as compared to a union, and what the implications are for talking about labour rights vis-a-vis civil rights or human rights if you're undocumented. Because the possibilities for organizing here actually depend upon people conceiving what they do as a common thing called labor in many ways. And I find the in the UK, union membership has gone down very drastically. And so there are a number of unions that are working with undocumented people and with poorly paid service provision. And in some ways it's positive because you get the shift from a question about human rights which don't exist to labour rights which do exist, but on the other hand you have the opposite, and which is that the unions no longer talk about labour rights. So that, I think, brings it back into the kind of labour history code.
Okay.
I have a related translation to and especially to Anne, is that the yes, because this you drew this macro perspective on domestic work, and so if there is this improvement, this rise in demand of domestic services, then why don't we have doesn't the bargaining capacity of domestic workers, it doesn't improve, and so then we have to interrogate the notion of work, to answer why this doesn't happen as it should happen.
Okay,
and the participation in the labor movement, the demand, improvement of that would lead to an improvement in wages, but we don't have this.
Sarah has something there.
I'll try to make it very quick. When I got up this morning, I decided to wear this little badge, which is a badge for Sunlight Soap. Sunlight Soap Company was one of the biggest now multinational company based in. But it's related to this question of the shift from work to labour and the various historical transformations of that, and the many of you will know this book by Anne McClintock called Imperial Leather about the history of soap and the whole idea of hygiene and the way that was kind of taught to the great unwashed in the UK. But in addition to that, McClintock used the study to try and look at how gender and sexuality were constituted not only in the colonies as a result of the development of this kind of work, but so that there was various people brought in to work for the men who were visiting in the colonies, but also that this was transferred to the working classes, this kind of information transferred to the working classes in the colony countries. The point being that this whole idea of how what happens in the domestic unit and in the household, and how that, whether that is work and how that relates to the different ways in which class is constituted. Because an awful lot of the workers who worked in the Sunlight Soap Factory were women, and they were being taught at the same time to use the soap at the same time as being exploited labourers in this new industry that produced the soap using the materials from the colonies. So I think that this whole question of how things become either work or labour and how that relates to the transnational question has been played again in the past as well, sort of being made in a different way, at least through the colony period of the UK, and that what's happening now seems to be not the same, but a transformation. So it might be worth revisiting the history issue.
I was just thinking the whole other colonized history, which comes up with gender ideology, about genders living separately between countries and all the African literature.
Yeah.
Is equally relevant.
Okay, let's have some quick responses, please.
Yes, in fact, I have focused more on what happens within the household, but that doesn't mean that the nature of work and worker rights are very important. Most of the women we interviewed were, in fact, domestic workers, but some also work as employees in tavernas, or fast food restaurants, etc. And what is absolutely crucial in their narrative also is their independent rights to have insurance, which guarantees the right to resident permits independently of the male members of the household. And also for those who work outside domestic work, so where we have a more traditional employee-employer relationship, they also focus very much on the exploitation they suffer, and they are very, very weak. There's no question yet to get them organized like it happened in Britain or something. The unions don't take this issue as yet very, very seriously. And even I happened to accompany an Albanian woman to denounce her employer to the service inspection, etc. But it was very difficult even to get her version right, and the employer, because it's a small market town, has very much power, so I very much doubt if she will get her rights. But it is a central issue, maybe less for Bulgarian livings, because they view the stay here more as temporary than Albanian women, but that may change, of course.
Yes, a number of things here. Very interesting about bringing men back into the equation, yes. And I think it's the same question, really, I think, in terms of the migration setting and the sending, or if you want to use those terms, the old binaries of sending society and migration setting. And I think that, I don't know, it's just a very difficult one, I think. If the men who are left behind say, this is not my job, yeah, this is, and it was certainly in our interviews, I think we only found a couple of husbands who had actually accepted that the caring responsibilities were their own. And I think in many cases that was the preference also of the mothers, that they looked even towards what some people felt was unheard of, their mother-in-laws to take on the caring responsibilities, you know, that it would usually be their mother or their sister or whatever, that they'd even sort of sidestepped the husband altogether and gone to his mother to be the one who the money was sent to, etc. So I think the sort of same set of considerations that we talk about in terms of not rocking the boat by hiring a domestic worker in the migration setting is the same set of questions that we have to ask of the sending societies as well. In terms of the unions fighting really for sort of human rights rather than labour rights, I think it's an interesting question, this, in that I think that in the case of the undocumented, their level of vulnerability is such that the kind of political right, the political legal, has to be solved before you can even begin to solve the sort of whole lack of contractual rights and things in terms of the employment sphere. And, I mean, one of the interesting things is once you get that visa, that work permit, then, you know, you are in a position to say, I have all these employment rights here. Yeah. Whereas when you're undocumented, I mean, you can put your head above the parapet, but you do so at possible huge cost to yourself in terms of deportation, which everybody knows is the thing that people are most concerned about if they do start again rocking the boat in terms of their bargaining position with employers. But I think it's very interesting because of the diversity, the real heterogeneity of migrants' immigration statuses now, that there are so many different battles going on so many different fronts. You know, so for instance, in the UK, you know, there is opposition to going along with the EU directive on temporary work, so that temporary workers would have the same rights as permanent employees. And so, because all the new migrants in the UK from the E8 countries, they're all on they all have temporary contracts, and they don't have equality of treatment with permanent staff. And in fact, in the UK, it's now the government is now saying, we're not going to let's do away with these work permits for overseas domestics, because, you know, we've discovered these E8 workers are really good and reliable, and all these Polish women and the Lithuanian women, they can do these jobs. Yeah, so it's so it's always on the move, I think, and it's always having to really look at what should come first. So, but I think, you know, I do think there has been a real step forward in terms of trade union attitude and practice to migrant workers. I mean, just in 10 years, they've had to move because, as you say, there's a massive drop in union membership. Yeah. And if it may not seem great. I mean, they got 4,000 domestic workers here as members, and they claim to have 20,000 new Polish members. So you can see that these migrations are actually extremely important for the existence, actually, the continued existence. They'd probably become dinosaurs if they didn't turn their attention to the problems of the position of migrant workers as a whole, even though they are very heterogeneous and they throw up all sorts of different challenges in their own way.
But and one of the challenges is precisely, I think, thinking about the relationship between labour and work, which could be very positive for union workers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'd like to add something to that.
Are you done?
Yeah. Okay. Just on the whole issue of organizing, I think it's interesting to conceptualize it in terms of labor and work, but what's distinctive about paid domestic work and what makes it so hard to organize is that it's not considered real work.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of informal sector jobs that are considered real work or as verifiable employment, but for all the reasons, rights, women's, natural labor of love, blah, 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 it's invisible. You can't see it once it's done. Unless it's not done, et cetera. But I would like to talk just briefly there about the organizing strategies from Los Angeles and the U.S. The main model is the 8 NGO model. It's the Community Worker Association, of which there's a very strong one in Long Island and San Francisco and New York and Los Angeles, wherever you go. And beyond, you know, the main obstacle I continue to think is that neither domestic workers nor their employers recognize paid domestic work as real employment, and most domestic workers, because it's a very stigmatized job, also do not identify as domestic workers, as women who are intending to be in the occupation for 20 years down the road. Everybody has a dream of how they're going to get out of the job, either going back home or opting out into some other, getting some other ring on the ladder. Also, it's a job where collective bargaining isn't possible because you have, right, you know, all of these different households, unlike the traditional union, 100 workers and one employer. So the community workers associations in, you know, Los Angeles and elsewhere have really worked on doing a lot of sort of employment education, kind of know your rights stuff, a lot of literature on, you know your rights. Wage and hour laws, it turns out, are on the books. There are pretty good wage and hour laws and Social Security laws that pertain to domestic workers, but it turns out neither domestic workers nor their employers know about them. So campaigns have focused on doing that kind of outreach. There's a whole bunch of advocates who work in legislature and, you know, have worked on changing the laws, upgrading them, particularly with live-in work. That's where the worst violations are by far in terms of wage and hour rights. And then I do want to say something about immigrants and unions in general, immigrant workers and unions. Main unions in the United States, AFL-CIO, were virulently anti-union between the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which was came about from union men trying to keep out Chinese competition, and until 2000. In 2000, the AFL-CIO did a 180-degree turnaround and said, "We're going, you know, we're making a concerted effort to mobilize women, racial ethnic minorities, and immigrant workers." And there's a huge immigrant workers' freedom ride based on the freedom ride movements of the 60s that took busloads of people to Washington, D.C. to advocate for legalization, or what you call regularization strategies. And all of this, the real heartbed of this was Los Angeles, where organizing by Latino immigrant workers in two industries really drove this movement. And it was the service industry unions, SEIU, also known as Justice for Janitors, janitors who clean corporate buildings, and also HERE, the Hotel Employees, Restaurant Employees Union, of largely Latino immigrant workers who work in hotels and big restaurants. Those unions have now broken away from AFL-CIO, and it remains to be seen what will happen. But, you know, just like England, unionization numbers have dropped, but there is this resurgence in the service industries now and coming out of Latino immigrant workers. It remains to be seen whether there's any connection. You see domestic workers marching together with the unions at, you know, rallies, but there's really different occupational barriers.
I just wanted to add another tension there for trade unionism as a whole, and that is illegal workers, because a lot of domestic workers in, for example, in Latin America are children.
Right.
And that poses a problem, because if they're underage, they can't be working, and therefore the trade unions have a problem in terms of representing them. Because they're not really.
What unions have done that is so interesting is they've done this, which is what you have to do in informal politics, is they've put in this umbrella organization. So, for example, there's one trade union of sex workers in Britain, which isn't directly part of the GMB, it's affiliated to the GMB. Yeah. So they can represent children or illegal workers, and having this broker agent thing is a completely. It's not new, because it happened in the 19th century, but it's a very interesting development.
But you need those kind of NGOs, if you like, to go out into the community to find the children. And then you need that articulation with a trade union-like group, which then is linked to trade union. So you need a sort of series of levels of intervention with these particularly vulnerable workers who are children.
Just a word, and we can pick it up again after you know, the next sessions. I would focus my intervention as well, not only in all these aspects, as well in the analytical on the analytical level. And I think that from my point of, from my historian's point of view, there is a fact that
historians of work have very seldom dealt with informal work, such as paid domestic work, and it has. If you look at labor histories, prestigious journals in English, French, or German, they almost never have anything, any papers, articles, or information on non-formal work. And so I think it's important that you anthropologists, sociologists, etc., know how this theme, this subject, is original. I mean, because it is better placed than me to speak about it, but it's original for historians, and it's important to think about the concept of work. What does this mean?
And I suppose that what we're currently discussing, I mean, you know, unionization and how unions have been transformed through their implication in informal forms of work, makes this kind of this kinds of work more recognizable, and therefore more susceptible to, you know, the historical sense of the future. Okay, I mean, this is a transformation that's been mediated by exactly these forms of political recognition that are being that take the forms of
and also more narrow, also at the same time.
Yeah,
because more conforming to known models.
Can I go back to the question? Because I didn't really answer your question about if, with the increased demand and increased supply of domestic workers, doesn't that, you know, isn't that going to be the tipping point in a sense for, you know, greater organisation? And I it comes back to this question about recognition of what it is that people do, I think, because there is a, you know, a very good European organisation now, Respect, of migrant domestic workers, very active. But again, this heterogeneity within the European Union of what is recognised as domestic work, and for instance in the Netherlands, there is no recognition of this type of work as something that migrants will come and do. So, and as I say, even in the UK, where we thought we kind of got things sorted, there's now a move to try and abolish the work permits altogether for overseas workers to come to do this kind of work with the proper recognition that it has and the employment rights that go with it. So, you know, as I say, this is it all the time. It's a very dynamic situation, and until I think there is a kind of certainly in Europe anyway, some kind of uniformity of acknowledgement of what domestic work is and what the baseline is in terms of, you know, like we have, say, in Hong Kong. I'm not saying it necessarily is always monitored in the way that it should be, but at least in Italy, there are contracts for domestic work. They set down exactly the number of hours, the, you know, day off, no hours of work, you know, and this has to be the kind of like minimum, I think, throughout the, certainly at least throughout the European Union.
For example, in Greece, living work is not considered work. I mean,
that's right.
Legislation does not apply, labor legislation does not apply to living work.
Yeah.
I mean, and of course, it's still the model is the family. So it's
Vasiliki, and then you want, Carol, do you want something? Yeah. Ah, okay.
I just wanted to express some thoughts, more narrowly anthropologically oriented thoughts, about this category of work. It's not given, obviously, as an analytical category, and maybe we should see it in the context of the household, a household that involves individuals that come from different cultures, that it's a kind of work that's informed by culturally defined or derived notions of what or of housekeeping. So it's not a, we have to see it in terms of situated knowledge, perhaps, culturally informed. We have to see it in a context of unequal relations whereby different conceptualizations are conflicting at times of what tasks and how and all of that, and have to adjust to each other. It's not... we hear women who employ in their homes foreign migrant women and say, I've skilled her, she's learned the job. So there is this idea, notion that it's not a being, a worker, it's becoming. Okay, it's being skilled, developing the skills that somebody else thinks one needs to have. So perhaps this, if we see work as an experienced, embodied kind of identity, that could sort of shed light on the concept itself, which is not a given, and it's an analytical category that we have to think about it in specific cultural contexts and the context of negotiating and actually adjusting different notions. I don't know. Am I being clear?
Yeah,
I mean, at the micro level.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the orientation that at least those who drafted this position paper are inclined to adopt and invite, everybody to think about, anyway. This doesn't mean that we abandon the notion of work, of course.
No, we do.
But to have a more historical, culturally specific way of approaching it and using it in what we are doing on the analytical level. Please.
I just want to say a few things about the Greek situation, because I think it's relevant. Last summer we tried to organize a discussion in the anti-racist festival on domestic work, and we invited representatives from different ethnic communities and labor union representatives. And the head of the, there is a labor union on cleaners. It's something similar to Justice for Janitors. Basically, their members are people who work in a company specializing in cleaning. So they are not, for example, women working in the domestic household sector in houses, they don't apply. Mm-hmm. Basically, so we tried to organize this discussion, this public discussion, and also the point about the situation in Greece regarding the migrant associations is very much based on ethnicity. So we you have different associations who are represented in the migrant forum, but it's very much ethnicity based still. And there is a women's group within the forum, but it is also very much based on ethnicity. Mm-hmm. So what happened in the discussion was that, first of all, the head of the cleaners association didn't show up without giving us any notice. The head of the workers association, the representative of the workers association told us that it wouldn't be appropriate to come to such a discussion, so they didn't show up either, and we ended up with the representatives of women's migrant associations from different communities, and the discussion was very interesting, and but it centered mainly around women's questions, as if domestic work is not really an issue that involves work and involves labor rights and involves political activism, as if it is a question of us women suffering because this is the kind of job that we have to do. And so from this experience what came out is that basically in Greece there's no space for this kind of activism in public discourse. I mean, there's no position where migrant women can talk from in order to become active in, whether it is the labor movement or the migrant movement. Mm. There's no place for them to actually speak from. It's as if they can only speak as women, as private individuals who actually do not have a political life. It was very interesting. It was all personal accounts of how working in the domestic sector is like.
Yeah, I think it's a useful point for the other sessions as well. Yes. And I will have to enforce the law here, because it's 1:10, so please. And
I don't really agree about this interrespect, because there are now some ongoing campaigns, etc., but I will speak
about the
intervention. That's the question
to Ricky.
If you met any, I want to ask if you met any cases where there are one income households and migrant households, and this income comes from migrant women. What happens then to this sense and ideology of male honor of men? How do they experience this fact?
Yes, there are women who support their families alone.
Families who live here, and the man is unemployed. For example, after the Olympic Games, there was a decline in construction sector. The Albanian workers were unemployed.
I am not encountered.
I have many questions to address to Ricky, but I will restrain myself, particularly in relation with retraditionalization and honor, which I find very, very provocative. But I will keep it for next sessions, and I think there are many points there which fit with our presentation, so perhaps we can have a debate on this issue. The time is 1:10. It's all right, don't worry, everything is under control. Evgenia Markova unfortunately couldn't manage it. So we have, she offers generously her 20 minutes. Okay, so we will do a 15-minute break.